Okay, this is Marianne Barasonic, and this is Between the Covers. My guest today is Justin Cronin. His first book, Mary and O'Neill, was a story about the redemptive power of love and won a Penn Hemingway Award. His second book takes place in a fishing village in Maine. His latest book, The Passage, is about vampire zombies and has shot up to number 12 on Amazon. Justin, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
So how does someone go from writing literary fiction about love and loss to vampire zombies?
That is a very good question. I think one of the things you do as a writer is you spend your career trying to figure out what kind of writer you are, and you kind of grow and change and evolve. I wrote my first book, because that was the book that felt like it wanted to be written. It was the book that I could write. And my second book was more like a kind of conventional novel with a big, with, you know, a pretty robust plot. Actually, it has some elements of a war story going on in the background. But I was, I was raised on really books of every kind. And I think I always really wanted to write a big, sprawling epic with a million characters and in the background, you know, of something that really made the story kind of urgent for all the people that were in it. And I grew up reading a lot of post-apocalyptic fiction, and that's definitely one of the traditions I'm working in here. It is indeed a novel of the vampocalypse. That is the word that I've seen that was invented on Twitter. I can't claim credit for it. But I think of it as a sort of in the tradition of the post-apocalyptic books that I read as a kid, which made a huge impression on me. I mean, it was sort of a natural thing to go back to that. I was maybe feeling a little nostalgic for the books that made me want to be a writer in the first place. So it made sense to go back to that.
Well, I think that there's definitely a apocalyptic kind of mentality that your story plugs into. I was watching the Colbert Report the other day, and they had this piece about there's a commercial business of underground bunkers designed to keep people alive after some huge disasters. And one of your characters says something like, we all know something terrible's coming, but we're not sure what.
Mm-hmm. Something's coming, something large.
Yeah. And so do you think that there's kind of this mentality where people are kind of really expecting something awful to be happening soon?
Well, I think we live in very anxious times. I grew up during the Cold War. I was born in 1962. So I grew up under that particular shadow. And the good thing about the Cold War, and it's the only good thing about the Cold War, was we really all knew what to be afraid of, because there was one danger that was so overwhelmingly large, it kind of outranked everything else and put it off the table. Since the end of the Cold War and since 9/11, I mean, I think we've been living in a kind of white-knuckle state of near panic at every minute, but we don't quite know what it is that's making us afraid. I mean, it's everything from terrorism, which, of course, takes so many forms you can't predict it at all. I mean, I think that was one of the major lessons of 9/11, was who would have thought, right, to environmental catastrophe. You can look at what's going on in the Gulf right now and just sort of stand back in a kind of, you know, dumbstruck awe at how terrible it is and how you didn't see it coming. And it's as if right now, whatever it is that's scaring us is kind of moving in the shadows, moving at night in the trees. And I kind of wanted to, I created a threat using sort of traditional vampire material, but retooling it to kind of capture that feeling. I actually started this book with kind of two public events very much in my mind. One was the war in Iraq, which in fall of 2005 was just looked like an utter quagmire, and of course caused me a lot of anxiety. I think it caused a lot of people a lot of anxiety. The other was Hurricane Katrina, which had just happened, and I live in Houston, Texas, and within about, I think it was like 6 weeks after Katrina, Hurricane Rita headed for Houston, and at one point it was a Category 5 headed right for Houston, and everybody tried to get out of town. And I was one of about a million people who got his kids and his dog into his car and hit the highway and got nowhere. I mean, the whole city choked on it. We got all of 60 miles away. It was 2 o'clock in the morning. Everybody was out of gas. We were going to run out of gas. Whole families were sleeping on the side of the road. All the mini marts were empty. The gas stations were ransacked. Actually, the veneer of civilization actually held to my astonishment. Under those circumstances, there really was no violence. But I felt very keenly how brittle this was and how you could just be swept over by it.
So it wasn't that much of a stretch to write those scenes where they come back and it's, what, 100 years later, and there's still these, the remains of these car jams and stuff.
Yeah. I mean, my characters encounter a landscape that is the world frozen at the moment of its catastrophe, essentially. And so they come across a line of 500 cars, that are half covered by dust, and they're the remnants of, a failed evacuation. Whatever happened at that spot 100 years ago was something pretty terrible, and the cars themselves are kind of corpses of that event.
The catastrophe is brought on by army experiments gone bad, and it just seems so plausible. Do you think that this kind of reflects a basic belief that the military is unaccountable for its actions?
Probably. I was feeling extremely, agitated when I wrote this book, just about military adventurism in general. I mean, I was the foreign policy of that moment, felt to me like a colossal mistake from which we could never extract ourselves. But I think it was not so much the military per se that was driving me crazy at that moment. It was my whole sort of ambivalent feelings about scientific progress. I mean, I was science is the magic of my lifetime. I love my iPhone. I mean, technology has produced amazing things, from healthcare technologies to communications technologies that provide things that we could never have imagined as kids. On the other hand, the dangers are vast. They're very real. Ever since 1945, we've been capable of destroying ourselves. And not so long ago, the Hadron Large Collider was turned on, and that was, great, wonderful scientific research instrument, but there was a group of researchers associated with the project who did admit just before they turned it on that there was some chance, extremely small, but a chance that the universe would disappear when they did this, and yet, grants are on the line, careers are at stake. Hurry, quick, pull the switch. And of course, we are still here, thank goodness, but it was, it's a sort of a good example of the risks that we take every day.
Maybe we've just become way too clever for our own good.
Oh, yeah. I mean, scientific, I don't want to say understanding, because sometimes it's not understanding. Sometimes it's just the urge to explore, which is a good impulse. I think that's a good thing about the human species, but it's way ahead of our ability or even our interest in considering the ethics.
Right. Or the long-term ramifications.
Yeah.
I think it's the long-term ramifications that really bite us in the end, and no one gives a thought to them.
No, we're just interested in the next quarterly earnings report and who gets to sit where. I mean, there's absolutely nothing else that seems to motivate, our political culture, our economy. It's all very, very short term. And sometimes that produces highly interesting entrepreneurial results. And a lot of the time makes it a complete mess.
Well, in writing this book, you got to sit down and create this world that all of the ramifications play out. So was the writing process different for you, where you have to put together this whole world building of this post-apocalyptic world?
Yeah, it was actually a very interesting and sometimes exhausting exercise in concentrating on absolutely everything. I mean, my characters live in a world where absolutely nothing is straightforward or is sort of where you use the materials that you and I use every day to get through our lives. I mean, I had to think constantly about what they wear, where they'd sleep, what they would eat, how they get fresh water. And I'm a grown-up English major. I'm not an engineer. I'm not an environmental biologist. The list of what I'm not is much longer than the things of what I am. So I had to become something of a generalist and, get a lot of facts, but then also hold in my mind as I was writing a kind of complex picture of realities that were very different from the one I live in. I mean, I would write about these people for whom every detail of their lives was sort of a chore and a challenge, as if they were like settlers in the Old West in some ways. That was sort of my model. And then I go have a ham sandwich in the kitchen and, watch the big screen TV, there's this sort of massive disconnect between the way I was living and of course I'm writing this on a computer and checking things on the internet. And meanwhile, my characters are just really worried about where they're going to get clean water.
Right. And does gasoline really stay good for 100 years if it's sitting in a tank?
that is a good question. And I will, every writer has to take a few liberties. I did need some running petrol.
Right. And then they get to raid the malls and that sort of thing. But it holds together, and it's all plausible, which is why it's such a fun read, because you do get transported to this world that's completely believable, but not at all what we have to deal with on a day-to-day basis. Now, Stephen King loves this book.
He seems to love this book. Yeah, he's spoken about it many times in many different settings, including on Good Morning America. When I was there, he ambushed me, or the show ambushed me with him on TV, which was really a thrill and a total shock. And people have said, like, how did you act so surprised? And they didn't tell me how I acted so surprised. I was surprised.
Really? And well, one thing I wanted to ask is, how do you get Stephen King to read your book? I mean, we literally get thousands of books a year here at the station, and he must get tens of thousands.
Yeah.
How did you get his attention?
I didn't. I mean, it was my editor who has worked with, I think, another writer or two who works in the genre that you could just loosely call horror. But, you know, I'm not a big believer in these sorts of labels on books. But so I think my editor had some conversation with him. I mean, he basically knew his email address, and I think they talked. And he sent it to him, just, you know, saying, the house is really behind this book. We really love it. We think it might be something you'd be interested in. And he sent it to him, and, you know, he picked it up and he read it, I think, is what it came down to. But they got it in front of him. And then it sounds a little self-congratulatory, but I guess the book did the rest, and he really, really liked it. And I'm just really lucky to have a writer with that kind of stature and that kind of audience and that kind of sort of breadth.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I can't say enough good things about Stephen King and his entire family and, you know, his dogs and, you know, everything about the guy. Because he's, you know, I think he's really helped the book find a lot of readers.
Oh, absolutely. He has so many fans, and they would just take his word as... Now, in the first part of this book, part of the action takes place here in the Cascades.
It does, yeah.
Do you have any connection with the Pacific Northwest, or did it just seem like the most remote place in the world to you?
Well, this is very interesting. I hadn't considered this. The book is full of places that I know quite well. And when you're writing a book that's sort of a story that's spread over pretty much the whole continental United States, you use places that you know because you do. You can't. I've traveled a lot. I've lived in a lot of places in the country. So Texas is important in the book because I live there now, and Tennessee, where I lived many years ago, and, you know, Boston figures, and Southern California, where I lived. But the Oregon thing is interesting, and I was asked this question by a blogger from Powell's, where I'm reading tonight. She said, "What's your connection to Oregon?" And it sort of stopped me in my tracks because I realized it's the place that I know the least. It's the only state in the continental United States that I'd have never actually been to until about 2 hours ago.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I've been everywhere else. I've never been to Alaska, but I lived in Hawaii for a while. So, I mean, I'm pretty well traveled in the United States, but for some reason, Oregon was one I had just kind of missed. And as a consequence, I think it had acquired in my imagination a sort of mythical status. Like, it was the perfect place I'd never been to. And I say this not to butter up your audience, but because I think this is really true. And I'd actually written a couple of travel pieces about Oregon many years ago when I was a freelance travel writer. And a lot of freelance travel writing is done without actually going to the place.
I was just gonna say, you've never been here and you wrote travel articles.
It makes me some kind of either massive fraud or a guy with a great imagination. But I would get research packets and I would have to write like describing scenic drives in different places, and some of which I knew and many of which I didn't. And so I wrote a number of things about Oregon. And I think first of all, that meant I had to imagine it, you know, really vividly. This actually turned out to be great training for a novelist. And at the same time, I'd never landed here. I'd never set foot here. So the scene in the book, the part of the book that you're talking about, is when a guy goes home to sort of his boyhood Eden, right? I mean, it's this sort of place where it's like sort of the perfect place for him. It's some place that he remembers as having this almost magical quality. So I gave it to the one place that I didn't know, you know, that had in my mind a sort of stature, you know, it was worthy of this kind of weight being placed on it in the book. So I'm very glad to be here finally.
Well, I would think it would be somebody who was, well, yeah, I won't make the comments about Coos Bay, but so this is the beginning of a trilogy then, and Is that right? And mm-hmm. we can look forward to a couple more books. There's, interestingly enough, there's web pages with video that kind of is supposedly tracking as this virus is spreading across the U.S. Have you seen those videos?
Yeah, that's
they're really scary.
Yeah, it's a sort of sidebar to the book and its official website, and it's very much in the tradition of the War of the Worlds radio play, which actually I had a huge influence on me as a kid. My parents grew up with radio drama, and when I was a kid, I had these records of old radio shows because they were big fans of it or whatever. Somehow it had found its way to me. And I would listen to these records, and people out there may remember records. I would listen to these records as I went to sleep. It was sort of, you know, my bedtime story. And the original War of the Worlds radio play was, of course, one that had great effect on people because it pretended to be real. I mean, that was the trope, you know, that it used. And it had the sort of texture of authentic news reporting. There are ways in which somebody should have been able to see through it, but a lot of people don't.
My grandmother, who was listening to it live when it first went on, swore that she knew it was fake.
Yeah. But at the time, she's pretty sure there are Martians in New Jersey. Yeah.
Right.
And my publisher thought it would be kind of an interesting project, given the importance of online now to publishing and to promoting a book, which is, I mean, we all spend so much time online now. It's really the only place to go, I think, to tell people about something like a book.
No, radio is still very effective.
Radio.
But yeah. This will wind up on the web, too.
Eventually, so. Sooner or later, everything winds up there. Yeah. I mean, I've listened to most of my own radio interviews because I confess that I do listen to them online. And so they decided to create this online website that would treat the epidemic, the great viral cataclysm, as if it were going on. So it's got blogs, and then they have these videos that where they hired a horror film director to do these shorts that are kind of in the vein of the Blair Witch Project, you know, kind of like, you know, it's an actual video, right? So in each case, there's a circumstance under which somebody would be using a video camera. It's somebody's webcam, you know, a girl's like working on her computer and there's a webcam so you can see what's behind her, you know.
Right.
Man, scary stuff. And then, a kid with a video camera stopping at night with his dad on the highway. So, yeah, and these things are completely unnerving. And I thought it was great, you know, and nowhere does it say it has anything to do with the book.
Right. Well, there's a link to them from like your book's website and that sort of thing.
Where you can get there from the book's website, but if you actually just hit that website, you don't know. There's nothing that says that it's the book, The Passage by Justin Cronin, available June 8th. It doesn't say that anywhere.
That's true. That's true.
And originally, the website, which is called findsubjectzero.com, was not linked to the book's website. Originally, there was no linkage at all. Like, you would have no idea. And so people would just wander into it, and then they'd tweet about it. And I would see, like, tweets about it. And most people, they were like, what is this? What's going on? You know, there was a touch of the War of the Worlds response to it. We got a very weird phone call one night at my house before we unlisted the telephone number from a guy in L.A. who was completely freaked out.
Really?
Yeah, because he'd figured it out, and he was mad, basically. He was mad that, you know, first he'd sort of bought into it, and then he'd figured out that it was a book by me, and he called me up to, like, yell at me for this. Happily, I did not take the call, but I guess that's the price you pay, you know, for this kind of trick.
I think it's also one of those things where you can't believe everything you see on the web, and this will prove it.
Yeah,
because
that's very good advice. Yeah,
here are these videos showing that we're getting vampires invading. So you are reading tonight, 7:30 at Powell's.
Correct.
On West Burnside.
The mythical Powell's, a bookstore I've always wanted to visit, so I'm very excited.
Well, write it into your next book.
Yeah,
it's a wonderful place. So this is the first one. Have you started working on the second one? You're probably almost done with it.
No, I wish I were. I mean, it was this year. I mean, I was working on it this year in general, but a book this long actually takes a lot of work after you're done with it. There's, you know, the copy editing process takes three times as long as it does on a regular book. And then I did a top edit where I made a lot of changes. So it's essentially working on this book until December, and then because of the sort of interest in the title and the good things that were happening to it, I had to basically start doing a lot of publicity work in the winter, late winter and spring. So, yes, I'm working on the second volume. I'm not as far along as I would have liked, but I'm in a good place with it. So when I'm done with the book tour, you know, that's my job. I'll just go home and, you know, sit down in my chair and stand up 2 years later with another book, I hope.
Right. You think you'll be done in a year if you're basically starting from, like a skeletal outline?
No, I've got more than that. I mean, I've got a lot of very detailed research, and I've got many pages actually written. So, you know, I try to write at a rate that is comfortable, and I just let the chips fall after that. You know, if I go too hard, I just start to, you know, write less well. I mean, I think there's a lot of books out there that get written too fast. And, so I take my time, but I'm still very, very productive and get a lot done. So,
okay. Well, my guest has been Justin Cronin. We've been talking about his book, The Passage, and you can talk to him tonight, 7:30 at Powell's on West Burnside. Justin, thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks. It's been a pleasure.